I think we're ready to start, if people would like to get seated. And I want to thank you all for coming out on such a dreary day. And, you know, all of us who've appeared on many panels like this know that an afternoon panel is deadly. And so we had a plan, actually, to get a bunch of the teams from the Beta Breakers yesterday and strut their stuff for you, but they all are still drunk, so we couldn't. So our plan B is this. We intend to have a sort of an interactive discussion up here. We're not going to go through each person presenting a bunch of slides. We're going to try to do it in a Q&A kind of a fashion, and we'd like to have you ask questions as well. But one thing I'd like to find out, because I know that we have all, or many of us on the panel have worked with many of you. I know there is stunning expertise in the audience here. How many of you work with registries, just by a show of hands? Great. And how about registrars? Great. How many of you are law firms and consultants? Okay. How many of you are brand owners? Now, see, that we cover the waterfront there, and I'm hoping, in fact, that you all will collectively find this a very enlightening or informative session. And in part, it's because I'm hoping that we will be able to talk with you as we go through this. Now, let me introduce the panel, and we've got quite an array of talent and experience in the GTLD space up here on the panel. To my right is Dick Downing. He's a partner in our New York office. He's practiced trademark law for 30 years and represents Fortune 100 companies in terms of their brand maintenance programs and has done domain name disputes as well as trademark litigation. Next to him is Bart Lieben, whom many of you know, and he's in our Brussels office. And Bart was there at almost the beginning, I guess, and I'm not talking about Adam and Eve, but at the beginning of the GTLD process, which some of you may think is as old as Adam and Eve at this point. But he has deep background in developing registrar and registry agreements and trademark policies. He has worked, in fact, on the launch of essentially every top-level domain in the last 7 or 8 years. Next to him is John Marino, who also is a tremendous expert in this area, because Bart, who is in our international dispute resolution and arbitration practice in our DC office, was one of the people who litigated on behalf of ICM Registry in the .XXX case, and currently is working with .jobs on an arbitration that was just filed, having to do with a notice of breach of the TLD of the registry agreement by ICANN. Next to him is Flip Petion, who is the co-leader with myself of our TLD GTLD group. And Bart has many years of experience as a WIPO arbitrator and Flip Petion has many years of experience in domain name dispute resolution. And he has actually been working with a number of Fortune 100 companies in terms of developing what the heck they're going to do about this new GTLD round. And then finally on the right is Terry Ross, who is also in the D.C. office with me and with John Marino. And he is an experienced IP litigator who's done a lot of different things, but in particular has done trademark litigation involving many e-commerce issues, keyword issues, domain name disputes, and the like. So we perceive of this process as one that is going to take many forms over the coming years, and we believe that we need a combination of perspectives like the one we've got on this panel here to understand the implications for brand owners and for clients into the future. Let's start just by talking about and by the way, my name is John Stewart. I'm in our DC office and I'm co-head of the TLD group. I want to start with a question to John, who attended the hearings in the House Judiciary Subcommittee the week before last, because that is maybe not just a bump in the road, but potentially an event that can tell us something as we try to read the tea leaves about exactly what's going to happen next. But John, you want to describe what went on at the hearings from your perspective?
Certainly. Well, essentially what went on at the hearings was a few hours of ICANN taking a beating on various issues relating to the new GTLD round and IP protection. At the end of the day, the outcome of the hearings and what it means for those of us in the room who are interested in the GTLD round is a little bit harder to pin down. It's altogether likely that it may be much ado about nothing. There was a lot of posturing going on. There were requests and calls for delay, but it's unclear whether there will be any delay. And the rollout of the round is still expected in June.
Well, and Bart, can you describe just in general what the lay of the land is in terms of government's efforts to continuing efforts to have their concerns addressed by ICANN before the launch happens?
Yeah, basically, the governance came in quite late in the game when you're looking at the actual comments that have been provided. So the first applicant guidebook that was published by ICANN was published in October 2008. And it's only, let's say, end of last year that the government's really tried to get much more involvement into this whole process. A couple of major concerns that they have is, of course, safeguarding their own rights, so making sure that they have some kind of a new voice or a specific voice in the approval of new GTLD applications. That's certainly heard by ICANN if you look at the latest version of the applicant guidebook that was published. There is a, let's say, almost de facto veto right given to the governmental advisory committee. So that's quite a substantial change in that whole policy development process. One of the other things that they're looking into is as well trademark protection. So they're trying to increase the standards, and certainly quite a few of you who are in the room here have been advocating that quite a lot over the past couple of years to have these higher standards in place so that trademark owners could either benefit from better protection mechanisms when registering domain names, and also if domain names get registered by third parties who have some kind of an abusive behavior with those, that you can expeditedly suspend those domain names with what's referred to as the uniform rapid suspension process that appears to get some traction as well within ICANN nowadays.
Well, notwithstanding this kind of the continuing efforts of the governments to delay or at least modify the process, Flip, what's your view about whether the timeline is still on track?
I think it definitely is, and there are a couple of reasons to say that. In March, when the previous meeting took place here in San Francisco, there was a clear request to have the time schedule set for the coming months, and the chairman has clearly expressed the view that there was the wish to really go on now, and that's why some deadlines have been put on table. And they have all been respected until now, and the next deadline is actually the 20th of June, where three of us will be there in Singapore. And I hope we will be the witness of the result of the board meeting where the whole program will be finally approved. And also, let's not forget that the chairman's, this is really his baby. I mean, he really wants to link his name to the realization of the whole program. And that's something that's not a legal thing, it's not a structural thing, but it's not unimportant to face.
Before we move on with the rest of our discussion here, is there a possibility that the entire program will actually be blocked? John, what's your view on that, having been to ICANN meetings and watched the board in action?
Is there a possibility? You know, yes. Is it likely? No. It would take a monumental shift in the movement, all sorts of organizations and forces, for something to actually go off the rails. It looks like it is going forward in the next few months.
So given the sort of, on the one hand, the momentum that's behind this, notwithstanding the history of delay, what are your clients doing in terms of addressing these issues and preparing for the process? Bart, what do you see among clients?
Well, depends, of course, on the approach that they take. There are quite a few clients who really want to go for a generic top-level domain, so a dictionary word, and of course they want to really move on because they have invested quite some time and effort into this, and they want to see some returns. So it's pretty normal for them to be quite excited about this. I must say that the majority of the brand owners, they are a bit more lukewarm about this, if not to say quite resistant. And of course, and it's one of the topics that we're going to discuss today. Some of them say, well, look, okay, this is inevitable, so we need to consider this, and we need to find good arguments to consider this. Others are merely looking at defensive options and see, not applying themselves for a proprietary TLD, but they want to know what the options are in order to derail others' projects that may come in the way. And these are the two, I wouldn't say opposites, because most of the clients approach those two aspects in the same in the same timing, I must say. So they are looking into proactive applying for a proprietary TLD, but then again also considering a third party who may apply for a confusingly similar extension and looking into defensive options defending their brand.
And that in effect is an outline of what we're going to be talking about. That is, we're going to look at what we think of and what we've learned from our clients are potential advantageous approaches that they see in pursuing a GTLD. And then we're going to talk about the process for protecting one's brand on the other side of the same coin and sort of spin out and talk about the various ways in which one can oppose a GTLD and including outside the framework of ICANN, and then talk about the next wave of second level disputes. But let's look first at the question of why apply and flip. If a client, and you've been through this discussion with clients yourself, if a client has not yet decided whether to seek a GTLD, whether to apply for one, what are the potential benefits or approaches that they're considering?
I would actually make a difference between the trademark-based GTLDs and the truly TLDs. For the first, there are many, many reasons why you would apply for a TLD. First of all, it helps you to enhance your visibility as a whole. It helps you to reduce, at the end, in the long term, reduce the number of extensions that you can use. It helps you to restructure your presence on the internet. It can be an indication for the company, and that is, of course, to be seen at on a case-by-case basis. It's an opportunity for you to show that you are there, that you are using a very new element that can help you enhance your brand position on the internet. It can have an impact on the search results on the internet. It enables a direct navigation. It simplifies, actually, the way you can sort of play with the brand. It gives you a guaranteed availability of domain names and also control over these domain names. And as we all know, there will be some policies to be respected. But after all, you will have that, as an applicant, you will have that control over it. You will have the possibility to have more descriptive email addresses. It will permit you to do client binding, and there are many other advantages. But that's for, let's say, brand-based GTLDs, and specific for the truly generic TLDs, there I would think of it's an opportunity to show that you have the intention to take some leadership in the industry in which the applicant is. And that's one of the main things for the truly GTLDs.
Now, Bart, there are other clients, I understand, with whom we've talked to see ancillary benefits beyond merely enhancing brand strength and efficiency. Would you describe some of them, please?
Yeah, certainly what we see in quite a number of projects with clients is that they are clearly struggling with managing their domain name portfolio. Most of them rely on large registrars, some of which are here in this room. But still, there's no necessarily centralized control over domain name registrations worldwide. So if you have a multinational company with 100,000 employees, you can never control each and every one of them whether they are now registering a domain name in a particular extension, and that they set up their own website using non-standard or non-conform templates and what have you. So some of them really see a brand TLD as the opportunity to standardize the way how they are reflecting their brand and positioning their company online. So for them, if you design policies and internal processes, for them it's an interesting way to make sure that everybody who registers a domain name in that .brand top-level domain follows the same rules, procedures, templates, and so on. So, of course, it's quite a huge investment. So only the application fee to be paid with ICANN is $185,000. But for them, it's worthwhile doing the effort in order to make sure that they speak with one voice and with one brand effectively. So increased control and management over their brand and the positioning of that brand online is certainly one of the big factors that our clients are clearly struggling with. We're also looking at increased security. For them, it's clearly an advantage to basically have their own infrastructure, have their own management tools available, which almost guarantees that domain name registrations do not get lost, that the system, the registry, will remain functional. We have seen a couple of hiccups with a number of smaller registries in the past. So certainly when relying on decent infrastructure and seasoned players in this field, this is clearly a risk that can be avoided by having a proprietary TLD.
And with respect to the first type of additional advantage, the increased control, that presumably is most advantageous for particular kinds of businesses. Is that right, Bart?
It depends a bit on how the business itself is structured. So if you have, for instance, a company that relies a lot on franchisees, where control is less strict than a centrally managed organization, at that point in time they can really see that as a big plus, as a big advantage, yes.
And is that, and I know that in terms of the clients we've worked with in approaching this from scratch, in effect, doing a strategic analysis for them, is that the kind of thing that may have entirely different outcomes for different kinds of companies?
Oh, absolutely. The way how we generally approach this is really looking at the ways how clients seek to use their top-level domain. One of the things you have with this process is that if you apply for a TLD and you ultimately get it from ICANN, then you sign up with them with a contract of 10 years. If during those 10 years you want to use the top-level domain in another way than you have described in the application submitted to ICANN, at that point in time there's a risk that you need to go back to ICANN, ask for a change of the contract. Those requested changes will be publicly posted. Everybody can comment on them. So this is really an issue that clients try to avoid. We see a lot of clients who hear people speaking about defensive applications being very limited in terms of use, very few domain name registrations, and keeping it very close to the brand owner itself. But assume now, or take the hypothesis where one of the competitors has a more liberal policy, is implementing very interesting things from a marketing perspective. At that point in time, that client who has this defensive or so-called defensive TLD may end up into difficulties. That is a process that can take a year and a half with ICANN, knowing that there's only 2.5 full-time equivalents doing legal reviews of contracts and so on. So for them, it is clearly something to consider. So what we generally do is looking at scenarios, how are you going to use it, and try to take that use and reflect that into the application itself in order to make sure that the client is safe and sound as from the outset.
Now, Flip, you mentioned before a truly generic TLD, and let me turn to you and ask you the question. What different considerations might there be, or what different potential benefits might there be to apply for a mark, a TLD, sorry, that is not a brand mark?
Not a brand mark. It's an opportunity to show that you are a leader in the industry. It's an opportunity to start up some relationships with some other companies in maybe related or other sectors, and you have so sort of you are the sponsor for others. Those are two examples.
Now, and Dick, with respect to defensive reasons to apply for a TLD, defensive reasons to take proactive action in this first round, what are you seeing clients considering, or why would a company with a brand to protect consider such an approach?
Well, let me start off by saying that Flip and Bart have outlined a number of the benefits of this new GTOT procedure, and there are quite a few. But that being said, as Bart mentioned, some of the brand owners are lukewarm to this process. I would go a step farther and say some of the brand owners are outright hostile to this process. They're perfectly content with their dot-coms, and they had to fight for years to get to this stage to beat off the cyber squatters to get where they are now. So many brand owners are taking a wait-and-see attitude, and they seem to prefer to wait, see what happens, and then take whatever action they can to try and stop it after the process has gone through a certain stage. That being said, there is at least one strategic advantage to filing, strategic defensive advantage to filing for GTOD, even if you don't intend to actually use it. The way the procedures develop now, if you file for a GTLD in your own name and someone else files for a similar name, you're put into a contention where you have the, first of all, you have the right to negotiate with the other party to seek and work out some sort of accommodation. And if you can't work out that accommodation, you go into an auction. So you can outbid the other party for the name that you're seeking to get. And then once you outbid them, if you're a company that has enough means to do that, you can then abandon your application. So you in effect, protected yourself without by filing, without going through the contention process other than the auction process. And if, on the other hand, you pay your $185,000 and no one else files for a similar mark, you can then withdraw that application and receive a refund of $135,000. So essentially what it's cost you is $65,000. So there are some benefits. It's not without question of short-term benefits, and it is expensive. But brand owners may want to consider that sort of middle ground alternative. Uh-huh.
I neglected to say at the very beginning that if you have any questions, please raise your hand, and we'll try to work you into the conversation. We'll answer questions at the end as well, but please feel free to ask a question if it occurs to you. Yes.
Yes, I have a question for you, Dick. I represent some clients in Europe that are considering to register for purely defensive reasons.
Right.
But I'm trying to find out, and I think you can help me here, if a brand is allowed to define himself as a community-based TLD, because that would maybe avoid the auction and then go into this, so that it would dominate a standard application if I had to the same name. Do you have any, would you know if it's possible? If ICANN would allow such a community definition of a brand.
So you're a brand owner and you apply for a community?
Yes,
GTLD?
You would define it as a community subsidiary.
I'm going to defer to Barton and or Flip on that, but I think the standards for community applications are such that most brand owners wouldn't qualify. Is that correct?
It's to be seen. I think you need to look into the brand itself. That's one. Two, mainly the distinction for community-based TLDs versus generic, truly generic standard TLDs or open TLDs, as they were referred to in the past, is made in order to give an advantage to community-based TLDs. Now, the question, of course, arises, do you really need that advantage? Because if you want to have the advantage, there are also some repercussions, namely that you need to adhere to the own self-imposed policies, that you have specific procedures, compliance procedures to adhere to afterwards. So it can be quite a cumbersome thing to do if you really want to apply for a community-based GTLD. Now, the first question is, do you think that there's a likelihood of contention? And that's a risk analysis that you need to make. If there's a likelihood, you can look into the criteria for community-based applicants and try to meet them in the policies that you're designing. Now, for some of the clients that we've done, that we've looked into, we have indeed been able to do that. Because, for instance, you have a user base, you have a community of users of services or of products of the brand. Certainly in terms of social media, you can find quite some examples where brands try to position themselves as more a community rather than just an identifier where products or services are sold. So the first question I would have is, do you really need that advantage? Because, well, the repercussions are quite significant. We have one client that may be interesting to know. He says, well, look, there is a likelihood, but we do not want to be bound by those community-based restrictions. So probably the route that they're going to take is they're going to file two applications, one community-based, one standard, and withdraw depending on what the situation actually is going to be.
There may also be some implications in the other direction in terms of what the implications for your trademark. But Terry, did you have something to add as well?
Yeah, so let me... I believe there are a narrow group of instances in which a trademark owner could file under community application basis. The problem is most of us think in terms of a community as being bird lovers, stamp collectors of the sort. I think you have to think differently. So the International Hotel Association has said they're planning on applying for .hotel. I would argue that they could apply under the community application. But let me give you that's not a trademark. How about Apple? Throughout the world now, or be more specific, let's say iPad. Throughout the world now, there are apps being downloaded by a community of Apple iPad users, correct? They have the phone, they have the pad now, they have the iPod. Why couldn't Apple make the argument that that is a community with similar interests and that they are an established institution representing that? I think there may well be a very narrow group of trademark owners who could take that position.
And my comment was only that depending on the circumstances, there could be adverse implications for your ultimate ability to protect your trademark rights. To the extent that you described it as somehow emblematic of a community, unless all the members of the community had bought your client's products and that was why they were part of the community, and then you run into this sort of other side of that coin. But to the extent that you define the community more broadly or diffusely, then you have some potential issues that you have to be careful of on the back end in terms of somebody challenging your trademark as having been described by you as a sort of a general community indicator. So, this raises the question, and obviously you've been discussing this as well with your clients, that there is a very, very large amount of unknown material here, and we have folks up here who have been studying these kinds of issues and the sort of nuances with respect to advising our own clients. But these may be questions that could have a different answer in the end, which makes this all very exciting. Let's turn now to looking just at the application. Any other questions, though? Let's turn to looking at the application itself. And Bart, in general, what's the time frame for brand owners to file applications for GTLD? How soon do they need to be preparing applications or engaging in analysis?
So certainly, if I can stick to the timeline of approving the program on June 20th, technically they could start for months after the June 20th, effectively, so that could already be there in October. And Edmund Chung from Dot Asia, who's sitting in the back there, we were joking today that apparently everybody wants to launch some program in the domain name world all the time at the end of the year, so that everybody gets excited when moving towards Christmas trees and what have you. So there is a chance that this program is going to go through by the end of the year. Now, certainly what we do recommend clients is not to start considering this somewhere October, November, because applying for a generic top-level domain is something completely different than just registering a domain name. So in that sense, what we do tell clients is carefully consider the uses that you want to make. So start off with a sound plan that has been discussed, digested by marketing department, by the legal department, IT department. Not focus too much on this applicant guidebook. Most of the clients that we talk to are very much looking into the applicant guidebook itself. Now, the applicant guidebook is basically, in our view, a risk management tool for ICANN. This is a list of questions to which you have to comply when filing an application. This is not how you effectively set up, implement, launch, manage a domain name registry. The issues that you encounter by doing that, let's say 10, 15, 20% of those have been addressed in the applicant guidebook. All the rest is basically not laid down in that text. So determining whether or not you want to go for it is not to be made just on the basis of the guidebook alone. So we're doing business analysis, we're doing risk management analysis, and that generally takes a couple of months in order to really complete that. You need to select technical operators. So most of the companies are simply incapable of doing this in accordance with ICANN standards. So we do have a couple of partners in the room here that can certainly assist you. We'll point them out to you later on. That takes time. These people need to try to digest that business plan as well and make sure that this TLD is implemented in the way how you think it should be implemented. So take a couple of months. That's for preparing the business plan and the application itself. There's a two-month window during which applications can be submitted. So let's say that the program will start somewhere mid-November. Let's be a bit cautious at this point. So mid-November until mid-January. It's not a first-come, first-served process, so all the applications that ICANN will receive will be considered. There is a very small little detail that has been added to the applicant guidebook in the last version that refers to the registration or the user registration period. So if you want to apply, you need to be registered as a user. The time frame for doing that will probably close before the application window closes. So do make sure that if you want to apply, that you're in the game as soon as you can. So do not wait like most of you will probably do. Well, I do that with filing tax returns until the last day everything goes in. So I don't think that's the best recommendation that we can give in this respect.
Yes.
Excuse me. It's sort of like a comment to what Bart just said. And from what we're seeing, I'm a registry services provider. What we're seeing from clients is that they tend to see, what you're saying, that this is merely a marketing tool or brand protection tool or whatever, without seeing technical underpinnings that are behind this. And you don't always get that from the guidebook. And I think it's a great point that Bart makes, is that you're actually getting a core piece of internet infrastructure here. And that's not to be underestimated. I think that there is quite a few decisions that need to get made that aren't in the guidebook. And I commend Bart for raising that point.
And in particular, that, as Bart also pointed out, and as some brand owners sophisticated in this area know, it requires a buy-in and participation by people across a company's organization, not just the marketing department, not just the legal department, not just the IT department, because the undertaking, once you've if you apply and are successful, involves much more of your business than just the marketing department. Yesterday, of course, was the deadline for filing comments on the latest version of the applicant guidebook. I know that some of you actually filed comments because I've read them, but who among you have looked at the comments that were filed through yesterday in this round? Okay, my favorite, by the way, was an early one that included the sentence, "No one has ever heard of ICANN," which might be true for a large segment of the world, and they're not in this room yet. But just in general, can someone on the panel summarize the thrust of the significant comments that were filed in this last round through yesterday? Flip, how about you?
Well, the main comment is actually coming from trademark holders or organizations that are expected to represent the trademark holders. And they keep repeating that they are against it, that they are worried, that it could well create quite a burden, that it will generate costs to defend the trademarks in extensions, and so on and so on. And I think that's actually the most important comment that is always coming back. There is, to be honest, nothing new under the sun.
And notwithstanding that ICANN has ignored the comments of the trademark community or the brand-owning community, John, what have you seen in terms of what governments are doing in this continuing struggle?
Well, governments have certainly taken have stopped taking a backseat in this process and have really been raised to the forefront. In the latest guidebook, there was ICANN extended an olive branch to the governments in providing for an early warning notice system in which the GAC, the Government Advisory Committee, can let the applicant as well as the ICANN board know that there may be a problem with this application.
Okay, now we're going to come back and discuss that a bit more as we talk about the objection process. We're shifting now to companies who have a reason to expect or are presented with a reason to object to a particular GTLD. First, in the administrative objection process, Dick, what are the grounds for objection and who can file an objection?
There are currently four grounds for objection. The first is string confusion. That would be that the sought-after GTLD is confusingly similar to an existing GTLD or an applied-for string. And obviously, in that case, you have to own a GTLD or an application in order to object. So that's the standing requirement. The second is legal rights, and that's a far broader grounds for objection. Anyone that owns or claims trademark rights can make an objection that the sought-after GTLD is confusingly similar to their own trademark. So there your standing would be that you have to have established trademark rights. The third is a community objection, and the standing there is you have to be an established institution associated with the community. And the fourth is the only objection that's open to everyone, and that's a limited public interest objection. And what that is, it provides for objections if the sought-after GTLD in some way is in violation of international law or established rights and morality. And anybody can bring that type of objection, but it appears that they will set up some sort of screening process to make sure that only serious objections are accepted and frivolous objections are rejected. So those are the four types. Of the four, three require standing.
Okay. Now, Flip, when can somebody file an objection?
Well, actually, we have to make a distinction between the objection that is provided in the applicant guidebook.
Yes.
And, of course, I'm a litigator. The court. I mean, you can always go to court. But if you would like to apply the objection system that is provided in the applicant guidebook, you can actually start to file an objection 2 weeks after the end of the application round. And there is a whole period within which you can do it. It's not very clear how long that is, but it could be between 5.5 and 7.5 months.
Is there a way to make an anonymous objection?
No, there is no way to do that, but there are other ways that are provided in the applicant guidebook and that are not the objection system, but you could actually contact the public objector and via the public objector insinuate or suggest objections that could be made by that public objector. And so that would be the way not to become known as the person having made the suggestion to object.
Okay. Terry, let's go back and look at the process chart. And what is the process that follows the filing of an objection? What happens next?
So you heard that there are four different types of objection. And the process that is followed depends on which type of objection you have. So let's start maybe with the string confusion. A string confusion objection would go to the International Center for Dispute Resolution, which has developed their own procedures. A legal rights objection, essentially a trademark confusion objection, would go to the Arbitration and Mediation Center for WIPO, who have a booth over at the exhibit hall. Both the limited public interest objection and the community-based objections go to the International Center for Expertise at the International Chamber of Commerce. Each of these organizations, each of these three organizations, have developed their own rules for TLD objections. It is hard to get a copy of them right now. But ICANN has said that they have to follow certain principles. So let me go through what ICANN has said has to be in these dispute resolution procedures. First of all, you have to think of the objection as being a legal brief, because you only, as the objector, get one shot at this. So you will have 20 pages in which to set forth your objection. What is the problem that you have? It will then get an immediate look over to make sure that it is administratively correct. And if it's a legal rights objection, whether or not, if it's a public interest objection, whether or not it's frivolous, just out of the bat. If it's frivolous, it'll be tossed out immediately. Otherwise, if it's administratively correct, a panel of experts will be appointed by one of these bodies. And that panel will then have the authority to consider the objection. The applicant, after the panel is appointed, will have 30 days in which to file a response to the objection. Again, think in terms of a legal brief here. And again, keep in mind it's only 20 pages long. There should be no public hearing or no adjudicative proceeding in person. ICANN stresses that there should be no document production. Now, that does not mean that the panel could not decide to have an in-person hearing and require certain types of documents to be produced, but ICANN would rather not see that happen. Once the paperwork is in other words, the objection, the brief in objection, the brief in response, there's a 45-day period in which this arbitration panel, dispute resolution panel, has to turn out a decision. They can ask for additional time, but ICANN again stresses they'd like to see it done in 45 days. And an aspect that I really like a lot is it has to be a reasoned opinion. One of the things those of us who do international arbitrations always hate is, in certain instances, there are not these reasoned decisions at the end of the day. You don't know why you lost or won, and it's a very, very frustrating thing. Plus, with these reasoned opinions, hopefully we develop some sort of stare decisis principles that will help in the future. The objector bears the burden of proof. It's not specified what that burden is, but we have to assume that it's simply a 51-49 sort of burden of proof. It is otherwise a very straightforward process, much like any international dispute resolution process.
Okay. And that, of course, is the sort of straightforward way to object within the ICANN framework by filing your objection and arguing your case. John, let's talk about some other sort of indirect ways to accomplish an objection or an opposition to a TLD involving government participation. Would you describe those?
Certainly. Well, when ICANN established this new mechanism for governments to provide an early warning, that presents the opportunity for applicants and non-applicants to consider going to their local government and lobbying and asking their government to work through the GAC to provide an early warning notice. So it's a way outside of the process-based administrative dispute resolution procedures to raise an objection. If you can go to your local government, you can have your local government speak to your government advisory committee member. They can raise that early warning, and it's a way of avoiding the other dispute resolution procedures.
And that's raised on behalf of or by a single government, is that right?
To draw a distinction between the early warning system and generic government advisory committee advice, yes, the early warning notice can be lodged by a single government who asks the GAC to provide the early notice to the ICANN board and to the applicant. That is distinct from government advisory committee advice. That takes a consensus, and then that advice is lodged.
But then it's not inconceivable that depending on the nature of the objection, that one could manage to persuade the GAC, a consensus of the GAC, to pursue that kind of objection on one's behalf. Is that right?
It's possible for those in the room who are very familiar with ICANN and the GAC inner workings. We understand that predicting whether the GAC can come to some consensus position can be very difficult. You could imagine 60 or 80 government representatives in a room deciding on what type of coffee to drink would be difficult. So getting that consensus can often be difficult.
Right. And John, let me just comment on that, because we see this in the United States quite a lot. You will go to the government and try to get them involved in a dispute, commercial dispute, and whatever government agency it is will say, well, you know, we'd rather see you work it out in the courts or in the administrative process first and then come back to us. And so I think it's going to be John's exactly right. You'll see a lot of disputes within the GAC. And I think it is likely that the default position will be go work through the objection process, then come back and complain to us.
Yeah, and I think that the reality, the realistic nature of this or not depends in large part on the significance of your industry to your own economy. That is, and we see this in other contexts with respect to criminal prosecutions that are designed to take down domains. The brand owners on whose behalf that is being undertaken in the U.S. in recent years are the movie industry, the sort of big fashion labels and the like. That is, people with some clout with the government. So certainly that whole process is one that has to be considered in light of what the political realities are as well. But John, let's not omit every possible. What about the ombudsman, the ICANN ombudsman?
Well, there are also some administrative procedures that you can pursue within the ICANN framework, but outside of the GTLD process. One of those is the ICANN ombudsman. It's probably not a position. It's not a mechanism that many would see as being particularly effective, but it is available. You can petition the ombudsman to review a decision by the ICANN board.
Okay. Now, let's, Terry, go back to the sort of mainstream administrative objection process. What if you don't succeed in pursuing, once you've pursued an objection through that process?
Well, the dispute resolution service provider, whether it's WIPO or ICC, in effect, their decision is only a recommendation to ICANN. And as to what to do with this objection, one assumes that it will be accepted for the most part, because that is the tradition at ICANN. However, there is, in theory, an appeal process, if you want to call it that. It's more of a reconsideration process. One could, after losing an objection, go and say to ICANN's board, please don't accept that recommendation, and there are two grounds for saying that. One is, since the decision came out, we have new evidence. I can't imagine what that would be. And the second one is, well, we read the reasoned decision from the dispute resolution service provider, and they completely failed to take into account the following material factor, which is critical to the decision, as if we hadn't brought it up. I honestly don't think that there will be very many circumstances in which ICANN will not accept the recommendation of one of the DRSPs.
Okay, now, John, in the ICANN registry case, which essentially involved an application for sponsored TLD in the last round of expansion, that in which there were criteria set forth, there was a process that was followed, and ultimately ICANN denied the request of our client, the application of our client for a TLD. What you followed something of a unique process in challenging successfully that denial. What was that process?
Well, outside of the gTLD round, what still exists is the mechanisms in the ICANN bylaws, one of which is called the independent review process, or the IRP. It is a distinct process in the ICANN regime, which calls for an independent, non-deferential review of an ICANN board decision. So it's also under the ICDR, the International Center of Dispute Resolution, and a three-member tribunal has a review to see if the action taken by the board is consistent with ICANN's bylaws and articles of incorporation.
And does that result in a, could that result in a reversal of the ICANN board's decision?
It certainly can. In particular, in the ICM registry case, it did result in a reversal of an ICANN board decision.
But the decision of the arbitration panel itself is not binding on an ICANN?
It's only been done once. The panel in that first IRP found that it was a non-binding declaration. The ICANN board said, or their general counsel at least said, it is indeed non-binding, but we will take it seriously and review it. And although it was a very controversial case, the ICANN board decided to follow the IRP declaration in the ICM registry case. So although it may technically be non-binding, it still has significant value, and it is something that the ICANN board takes seriously, and in this case actually followed.
And on what basis did you file? So that was a case that involved the initial delegation of a TLD. In your .jobs arbitration, that involves a TLD that was delegated, and now there's a declaration or a notice by ICANN that the contract has been breached. What process are you following to pursue arbitration in that context?
Well, once you're awarded the TLD, there's a provision in the contract for dispute resolution. In the registry agreement from 2004, that's an ICC arbitration, and that is what Employee Median through their .job string is pursuing against ICANN.
Okay. So now, after looking at all these alternatives, Terry, is there a set of potential remedies for an objector or a disappointed objector outside this ICANN process?
John, I think there is. I'd very much be interested in hearing what other people in the room might have to say, but let me toss out my views, and these are very academic in nature, given that we've not gone through this yet. My approach is to look at this as saying that there is nothing about this gTLD process that in any way amends the Lanham Act in the United States or equivalent laws in the EU. And therefore, if someone is given the right by ICANN to operate a new top-level domain that causes or poses a likelihood of confusion amongst consumers here in the United States, I would argue that you have a cause of action for trademark infringement or unfair competition under the Lanham Act, and that you could go into federal court and get an injunction to stop the delegation of that TLD. Now, there are a couple caveats to that. One is an applicant in signing the application agrees to a whole bunch of terms, including a thou shalt not sue the ICANN under any circumstances for any reason clause. And it is very possible that an applicant could also be an objector. It is unclear to me whether or not that entity would be able to do what I've suggested. An objector who is not an applicant signs a term in its objection papers that says, I agree to be bound by the dispute resolution procedure of the DRSP that I'm applying to. I don't think that prevents you from filing a Lanham Act action. I think it means you've got to go through the arbitral steps. But at the end of the day, it does not say thou shalt not sue in a federal court. And so I think an objector could go into federal court or in Europe into court and attempt to stop this from happening. But I'd like to hear what other people have to say on that.
Well, and Dick, in your view, would it be wise for someone who has an objection to a TLD that's been applied for to keep their powder dry and go to court or not?
Well, let me start off by saying I agree 100% with Terry that this new process does not revoke the Lanham Act or any other trademark laws in any country. That being said, I think and it's going to depend on the circumstances and how these things play out, but I think in most cases it would be wise to proceed with the administrative remedies first and see what you get out of that before you go into federal court or court in any other country.
Does anyone in the audience have views on this admittedly speculative possibility?
One of the real problems here is that you have to make this decision about whether or not you're going to be an objector relatively early. And you could, in effect, by filing the objection, be hurting yourself later on if it fails. And so you're on the horns of a dilemma. Do I file the objection or do I wait? If you don't file the objection and wait, it is possible that a federal court says, you know, you had this administrative opportunity that you did not pursue, and we're going to find that you did not exhaust your administrative remedies. And you're out of luck. Now, I would hope that's not the outcome, but you are on the horns of a dilemma.
Flip.
Oh, I would like to add that it's very depending on the culture where the parties are actually starting the litigation. I cannot withhold myself making the observation that the French people, you have a French lawyer here in the room, the French people will definitely find a way to go to the Court of First Instance in Paris and the Court of Appeals, and they will go to the Cour de Cassation in France. It's a typical country. Just look at the Louis Vuitton cases, the Google cases. Yeah. It's a country that has shown that it is absolutely wanting to be different. You know, it's also a country. It's a bit frustrated in the sense that it has no control whatsoever on this process. It has almost no say in setting up the rules. That has always been typical for that culture. And I would expect that if there is some TLD that is sensitive for a French company, that they would at least try and take that initiative.
Anybody from France out there?
But we know that in some cases there has been found a sufficient nexus with French jurisdiction, and we've had conflicting decisions on the same effective intellectual property issues and conflicting decisions about the extent to which those conflicting decisions apply in the other jurisdictions. So I would certainly anticipate that there will be many kinds of questions, first in terms of advising clients whether and where and how to sue, and then in terms of enforcing such a decision in an effective way against a GTLD that's been granted. There are some real challenges ahead, yes.
David Taylor also asked
about a true
French.
Abba, who is.
Wow.
arguably is the key word there. We want to just, we've got about 15 minutes left. I appreciate your patience and your interest in this, but we wanted just to touch then on the sort of next wave. There are miles to go before we sleep and get to the domain name disputes that may well follow with the new proliferation of TLDs that we're expecting, that many expect to see. But Bart, after they've been delegated, new TLDs have been delegated, what kinds of brand protection mechanisms will there be for brand owners?
Yeah. So clearly, as you said, new gTLDs applying or not applying for a proprietary TLD, that's headache number one for brand owners. What will come after is probably even a bit more painful experience. Looking at the sheer potential of brand infringement. Clearly, the trademark groups have lobbied quite strongly with ICANN to have more protection, rights protection mechanisms in place once TLDs will come across. If you look at ICANN's business plan for new gTLDs, they expect about 500 applications, but it could be 100, it could be 1,000. Basically, they don't know. But their business plan has been drafted on the basis of 500 applications. Let's say that about 400 of those will come across. Generally, it takes the whole evaluation and dispute resolution time frame takes about a year, maybe a bit more, to complete. So that will imply that you have 2 years during which new gTLDs will come across. If that's 400 TLDs within those 2 years, that will effectively imply that one TLD will be launched every working day for a continuous period of 2 years. So that is clearly a headache for most of the brand owners. Hence, the reason why ICANN has established at a certain point what is referred to as the implementation recommendation team. Both David Taylor and Jeff Newman from Newstar were members of that team. And the whole idea of the implementation recommendation team is come up with a couple of workable solutions on how brand owners' concerns could be mitigated and could be accommodated effectively. So two very important new processes were put in place. First of all, a pre-launch mechanism. Mechanism that basically has two different components. The first component is a sunrise process, a limited period of time during which the registry of the new TLD will allow certain brand owners to register, defensively register their trademarks. And in addition to that, also a so-called trademarks claims process where a trademark owner can say, well, look, I have trademark rights with respect to this particular domain name. If a third party wants to register that particular domain name. So it's a bit, it's a warning system and it's a defensive registration system that will be combined effectively when a TLD is being launched. So that's the first very important aspect, sunrise and trademark claims. So hence, trademark owners can avoid domain name registrations that may infringe their rights. Secondly, as a post-launch mechanism, what ICANN tries to establish next to the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy that now exists for about 11 years is the Uniform Rapid Suspension process. So what is referred to as in slam dunk infringement cases where a domain name is obviously targeted or is aimed at infringing the rights of a third party. Looking at the fact that certainly in the UDRP the response rate is rather low, so that the domain name owner does not really submit a due response within the time given to the trademark owner, given to the domain name owner. There, the trademark owner can benefit from this expedited process where a domain name is not transferred. That's certainly something that INTA is also quite advocating at this point, but it is effectively suspended, so it will resolve into some kind of a holding page that basically says, well, look, this domain name has been suspended under the uniform rapid suspension process. So it's a more expedited and a less costly procedure as the UDRP is, and really intended only to be of any use in obvious cases of trademark infringement. So these are the two main processes. So you have a preventive system, sunrise, trademark claims, and you have a defensive, an enforcement step where, or an additional enforcement step, which is the uniform rapid suspension process.
Terry?
John, a lot of companies have come out publicly and announced they're going to apply. Deloitte, Canon come to mind immediately. So for .Deloitte and .Canon, a number of companies have now started saying we're not going to apply. Today at one of the concurrent sessions, if anyone was there for this financial and insurance services trademark session, the trademark in-house trademark lawyer from Merrill Lynch announced that they had completed their process of review and had decided not to apply for a TLD that I guess would have been Doc Merrill Lynch. And he said at the end of the day, the rationale was they thought Doc Merrill Lynch was too long. And indeed, anybody who has an account with them knows that they go by ML.com. They don't use Merrill Lynch. But he said it in such a way as if that was the end of Merrill Lynch's need to worry about this. And I think that is probably the biggest mistake a trademark owner can have. Even if you decide not to apply, you have to follow this process in a defensive manner and be prepared to object, to jump in and object. And once the TLDs start being transitioned and delegated, as Bart said, you have to be prepared to utilize the sunrise provisions to register so, and then to keep track of what's going on. So, and it's one of the reasons why INTA has had problems with this whole process, because it will inflict this cost of monitoring upon trademark owners. But once you decide not to apply, that's not the end of a trademark owner's responsibilities in this area.
Indeed. And but that may be the end of our presentation here. We've got a few minutes left. I wanted to mention that we're going to have our next webinar on June the 14th, which is going to follow the issuance of the final, we think, final applicant guidebook, and precede the Singapore meetings. We invite you to participate, and we appreciate your attendance here. Does anybody have any additional questions they'd like to raise for the panel? Yes.
Sure.
Is there a cost for registering?
The principles of the Trademark Clearinghouse are currently laid down in the applicant guidebook. They basically go back from even before the IRTU has been formed, but the IRTU clearly took that as a very good, it's not really a rights protection mechanism, it's basically a system that supports rights protection mechanism. It's not a rights protection mechanism in its own right. So basically what the Trademark Clearinghouse is intended to be is a centralized repository that can then be used by trademark owners, by registrars, and by registries for managing these types of sunrise or trademark claims related processes. So the idea there is that the trademark owner submits his trademark claims. Those can be registered and unregistered trademarks. They need to pay a fee. What that fee is not really clear at this point. And also, ICANN says, well, look, all the users of the Trademark Clearinghouse must contribute to the cost of that Trademark Clearinghouse. But ultimately, it's actually only the trademark owner that really uses it. The other ones make use of that repository in order to support the trademark owner's claims or enforcement or defensive registrations. But effectively, it's only the trademark owner that really needs this. This is in order to avoid that all the launch processes become extremely cumbersome.
It's really
that is the whole objective of the Trademark Clearinghouse.
Okay. Other questions? Well, thank you again very much for being with us on this rainy afternoon. We will, of course, the panel will be around after the close, and we're going to be moving to a reception in about a half an hour, but would be very happy to answer questions. And I urge anybody in the audience who could benefit from this to take advantage of the presence of so many folks from registries and registrar companies here who know quite a lot about what's necessary to put together a strategy for this. I'm not going to suggest that competing law firms, David, also stand in this corner of the room to answer questions, but there's lots and lots of brain power, and David, you're among them, in the room about the process. And so I urge you, if you're interested, to take advantage of that. Thank you again, and we very much appreciate your participation.
Sorry? Okay, thank you. For those who would like to get to know a bit more of the ins and outs of the technical side of managing a registry, so we do have in this room, so if you go to the cocktail, some of those people will be around, so you can certainly grab them. I'll identify them to you. So if left, Adrian Kindres from OS Registry and Krista Papak sitting here. We have Roland Laplante from Affilius. Jeff Newman, Newstar, is there as well. And...
Cut that out.
And we have Jean-Christophe Fignet as well from Open Registry. So if you'd like to know more about the technical ins and outs of running a registry, these are the people to talk to. Thank you.